Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's tempting to say the healthcare debate's all over, but the shouting. Of course, a lot could happen between now and the vote. Today, a look at what happens right away, if it passes. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. ConstantContact.com. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and Progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Happy Friday, gang. It is the 19th of March today. There is a vote scheduled in the House for sometime Sunday, up or down on the health care bill. Assuming the thing does make it to the president's desk, some people's lives are going to start changing right away, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
If the health care bill passes, insurers wouldn't be able to deny coverage to children with pre-existing conditions starting almost immediately. That would apply to the O'Reilly family. Natalie O'Reilly says her daughter Sophie has chronic problems with her right lung.
It just kept collapsing, and in doing so was making her very sick.
The only insurers who will take the O'Reillys wouldn't cover Sophie's lung problems. O'Reilly is cautiously hopeful about the health insurance bill. She's happy that they could get insurance as long as the premiums were affordable. There's another provision of the health care bill that would help families. Children would be able to stay on their parents' policies until they were 26. And starting this year, insurance companies couldn't drop people in individual plans if they got sick. Jean Marie Abraham is a health care economist at the University of Minnesota. She says it doesn't make sense that insurers can drop sick people now.
Insurance is designed to help people when they have a catastrophic health event, and that seems counterintuitive to the purpose of insurance.
Austin Frecht is a health economist at Boston University. He says in a few years, insurers wouldn't be able to deny anyone coverage because of a pre-existing condition. In the meantime, people denied insurance could get coverage through a high-risk pool.
So they're doing what can be done easily and inexpensively right away. And then things that require more setup and are more costly have been pushed out a few years.
Of course, the whole plan will be pushed off a cliff if Congress doesn't pass the health care bill. If the House passes the bill Sunday, it should land in the Senate next week. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
This was Alan Greenspan Day at the Brookings Institution. The former Fed chairman presented a 48-page defense of his tenure running the central bank, as our senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports.
Greenspan's critics say he's conveniently forgetting the past. He says now that regulators did too little to halt the rise of those too-big-to-fail banks, but just 5 years ago, he was selling the country on his hands-off approach.
The impressive performance of the U.S. economy over the past couple of decades, despite shocks that in the past would have surely produced marked economic disruption, offers clear evidence of the benefits of increased market flexibility.
The Cato Institute's Gerald O'Driscoll says it was Greenspan who led the charge for deregulation, and worse, he says, for that hands-off approach.
The Fed had statutory authority over the whole array of people making mortgages since 1994, and there was just non-enforcement of basic banking law.
Greenspan also argues it wasn't short-term interest rates that fueled the housing bubble, but long-term rates the Fed has little control over. Not so, says Frederick Sheehan, who wrote a book on Greenspan titled Panderer to Power. Sheehan says Greenspan actually made a speech early this decade promoting short-term adjustable-rate mortgages, which grew from 2% to 67% of the California market.
So the carnage today is directly from the short-term interest rate policies of the Federal Reserve.
The author of another book critical of Greenspan says the former Fed boss is not one to admit mistakes. William Fleckenstein co-wrote the book Greenspan's Bubbles.
He's just trying to avoid any blame. It's just so obvious. And the fact that people let him get up and say this kind of nonsense and don't boo him off the stage is mind-boggling to me.
For his part, Greenspan says the good times lulled regulators into a sense of complacency. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, that 10-day trend of the major indices inching higher. Oh, that's all done. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Washington has been caught up in the political finale of the health care debate this week. But over here in the land of business and the economy, it has been an interesting couple of days of financial regulation from regulators past and present. Here to do our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond with us, we have Felix Salmon. He's from Reuters. Also, Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. Hi, guys.
Good to be here, Kai.
Great to be here.
First of all, Felix, you are now like the roving correspondent for Reuters. We had you from Davos, and now there you are down in Austin at South by Southwest, man.
It's much sunnier and warmer than Davos was.
Yeah, and listen, let me just follow up on something we did yesterday on the broadcast, this Foursquare thing. Are you on Foursquare? Can I find out exactly where you are?
If you go into Foursquare right now, it will tell you that I'm at KUT Radio in Austin. It's kind of necessary, I think, at South by Southwest because the cell phone network breaks down and it's the only way to find out where anyone is. I haven't quite decided how much I'm going to be using it once I leave this little techie bubble that I'm in right now.
The confines of Austin, Texas. All right. Well, we will have to leave that subject for the moment, but we'll go someplace else equally entertaining. Capitol Hill, Mary Shapiro, the chairwoman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, said this week, following up on the Lehman Brothers report from last week that we talked about on the broadcast. Listen, she said, we're trying to do our job better. Keep an eye on these guys. Lee, any belief at all that the SEC is going to be able to do that?
I don't know. I mean, the SEC is just facing a really long road to redemption. You know, it missed Madoff completely. It missed Lehman. It took the bankruptcy examiner to come up with the most important aspect of what Lehman was actually doing. And then this week, we had something else come out that last August, the SEC was basically lobbying with 12 Wall Street banks for the pullback of restrictions on stock analysts that was part of this big 2003 settlement. So it was basically lobbying to have the relationships between analysts and investment bankers, you know, allowed to be a little bit cozier. Hmm. So it was pulling back on the very issue that was at the heart of the last crisis, actually two crises ago.
Felix, your thoughts on regulatory goodness, shall we say, are they any good?
The SEC is particularly toothless. And even after Mary Shapiro has taken over, they've been soft peddling with people like the former CEO of the American Stock Exchange, who was violating all manner of SEC rules and got off with basically them writing a letter saying that was a very bad thing to do. And they're full of lawyers is the fundamental problem. They're not full of people who can uncover wrongdoing on Wall Street. And when they do uncover wrongdoing on Wall Street, as we saw in the Lehman Brothers report, they ignore it.
Well, so Lee, is it a matter of private enterprise, that is to say, really smart people on Wall Street, being more agile than, and I say this not pejoratively at all, government bureaucrats who are restrained by necessity?
Privately held firms on Wall Street are just going to try and make as much money as they can. I mean, that's their pure motivation. I think there needs to be some regulation. But I do think that this gives credence to the argument that the existing regulators have this anti-regulatory bias. And it's why the head of the SEC, Mary Shapiro, says on Capitol Hill this week that she is trying to change the culture. And that's what it's going to take. But that's just not so easy to do.
Let me change gears here for a second, then, to a guy who used to be a bank regulator. His name is Alan Greenspan. As we talked about up at the top of the broadcast, he has this paper out basically defending what he did as chairman of the Fed and saying, listen, this financial crash wasn't my fault. Felix, your quick thoughts on his defense.
Of course it was his fault. It was his fault. He actually admits that the failures of regulation were largely his fault, that he was relying too much on the private sector to regulate itself, and that when he did see issues with the mortgage lenders and the like, that he ignored them, thinking that they were isolated rather than systemic. But where he tries to defend himself is on monetary policy and on interest rates, yeah, saying, I kept interest rates low, but that had nothing to do with inflating the bubble. And that's just simply not credible on its face.
Lee?
This does, I agree with Felix's point, low interest rates did absolutely inflate the bubble. And, you know, I think it's an interesting shift. This is the person who's always argued that the market is the most effective regulator. He is saying now that there is a need for greater regulation and even suggests a couple things that we need to do, like enforce capital requirements. So it's a good read.
It's good, yeah, 48 pages, reasonably quick.
Right.
Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine. Felix Salmon, he's from Reuters, but today from the studios of KUT down in Austin, Texas. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Kai.
Thank you.
Toyota seems to have caught a break in its ongoing unintended acceleration nightmare. Federal safety officials say from the car's black box, it sure looks like that New York woman who crashed her Prius into a rock wall was actually pressing the gas pedal, not the brake. To be sure, there have been substantiated problems with the brakes on some Priuses, but commentator and comedian Mark Jaffe says the Prius brand might actually benefit.
As the owner of a 2010 Prius, I'm concerned about the recent problems associated with the car, but I have to say that I am thrilled with my Prius and Toyota. This fiasco has given me a whole new persona. I used to be Mr. Responsible, a guy who cared about the environment but always lost the chicks to the dashingly dangerous sports car driver. Now, I'm the one who's dangerous and turning heads as I cruise around a bottle of lemon-flavored water in my cup holder. Back when a Prius was a sign of staid prudence, my wife complained that I had begun driving like an old man as I would ease up on the gas pedal for better mileage, driving below the speed limit. Now she swoons when I walk in the door safely after a grocery run, perhaps a little surprised that I've come back alive from facing such peril. Who's potentially going too fast now, baby? Driving has become a pleasure. I hate having cars blocking my way. As of last week, I feel like Moses as I watch the sea of drivers part in front of me to get out of my path. The wide open road beckons. Oh, what a feeling, Toyota. Man, I'm not worried about speeding. The cops seem to have granted me immunity. I think they're afraid that stopping me will mean literally getting in front of me and stopping me. I once saw someone driving a Prius with yellow and orange license plates, which here in Ohio signify that they had been caught for drunk driving. I thought that there was some kind of incongruity in that picture. It screamed responsible irresponsibility. I don't know what it was saying. I care, but not completely. My car's not a guzzler, but I am. But now I understand the zen of that dichotomy. If Toyota is looking for a spokesperson that exemplifies the whole new Prius image, then I am he. I am conscientiousness and danger rolled into one. Dependability and risk in a single combustible package. Watch out, honey. I'm coming at you as fast as this accelerator will take me, while still getting at least 40 miles to the gallon.
Mark Jaffe is a comedy writer. He lives near Cleveland, Ohio. You can write to us no matter where you live. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Coming up, one definition of what it means to be undocumented.
I just want to be recognized as an American because that's what I feel like I am.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average peeled off 37 points this Friday afternoon. A third of 1% ended at 10,741. The NASDAQ down 16.7 tenths%, finished at 2374. The S&P 500 nicked off 5 points, about a half percent, met the bell at 1159. For the week, the Dow ended up 1.1%. The NASDAQ ticked up 0.3%. The S&P 500 climbed 0.9%. Healthcare stocks perked up today ahead of that vote on healthcare this weekend. Insurers stand to gain millions of new customers, so Aetna stock fattened up 3.75% after the insurer upped its forecast of first quarter earnings. Boeing lost 0.2%. Today, the aerospace company said it would move up production for two of its wide-body planes, the 777 and 747. It cited increased demand there. Palm handed off nearly 30% today. The smartphone marketer said quarterly revenues would plunge. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By American Public Media, announcing Krista Tippett's new book, Einstein's God, Conversations About Science and the Human Spirit, available in bookstores now. And by Vanguard, reacting to the stock market is investing. Taking stock in long term is vanguarding. More about vanguarding at Vanguard.com. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on podcasts. You'll find Marketplace, The Morning Report, Marketplace Money, and more, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Atlanta, the AARP and other organizations convene a career fair providing assistance to older job seekers hit by the recession. It is just one in a series of fairs scheduled around the country this year. In Washington, Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner talks about financial regulatory reform at the American Enterprise Institute, and Legally Blonde actress Reese Witherspoon turns 34. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Transportation workers over in the UK are mad as heck, and they are not going to take it anymore. Railway workers approved a strike resolution today after negotiations broke down. Another major labor dispute is going to take off tomorrow between one of the country's biggest unions and British Airways. BA cabin crews are set to strike for the next 3 days and then walk out again later this month for another four. If you're scheduled to fly, well, hopefully you've already made other plans. From London Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
The music in BA's advertising may be ethereal, but this dispute is rancorous.
Everybody can see that this is a trade union trying to destroy British Airways. That is what this is all about.
This is a very serious industrial dispute with an employer that is hell-bent on destroying our members' wages and terms and conditions and destroying this union.
BA wants to cut cabin staffing levels, freeze basic pay, and put new recruits on a less generous contract. Analyst Howard Wealdon says this could be a make-or-break battle for an airline that lost $600 million last year.
If it doesn't change, if it doesn't bring its cost base down, if it doesn't slim down, then it won't survive.
BA is well prepared for the strike. The airline says it can maintain two-thirds of its flights. It's recruited thousands of volunteers from elsewhere in the company to replace the strikers. Mark Pilling of Airline Business magazine says this is the perfect time to divide the workforce.
Because the airline is in a worse shape than it's been for years, you know, this is the time when you can go to your staff and say, look how bad a situation we're in. We need to do something to remain competitive. Otherwise, let's face it, we won't be a viable business.
But the union representing the cabin crews is not called Unite for nothing. It's appealed to foreign unions across Europe and in the US to join the fight. And that appeal has paid off, says Gabriel Mocho of the International Transport Workers Union.
Depending on the possibilities of each union and the legal framework of each country, a lot of unions have already informed us that they are going to support the strike.
The legal framework, however, is critical. It's still not clear whether baggage handlers in Italy, air traffic controllers in the US, or aircraft refuelers in France would be allowed to take action against British Airways flights. And Unite is coming under intense pressure much closer to home to call off tomorrow's action.
It's the wrong time, it's unjustified, it's deplorable.
British Prime Minister Gordon Brown.
We should not have a strike. It's not in the company's interest, it's not in the workers' interests, and it's certainly not in the national interest.
And it's not in his interest either. Unite is his paymaster, the largest donor to his Labour Party's campaign funds. With a general election likely in 6 weeks, Brown doesn't want to be linked with travel chaos and cancelled vacations. The strike has already disrupted thousands of travel plans. Nick Wooten had arranged to fly BA to Las Vegas for his honeymoon. Rebooking with another airline will prove too costly.
I think it's affecting a lot of people, myself personally. It's taken us a year. We've planned for this over a year. I am devastated by it.
BA may well win its showdown with the union, but it seems certain to suffer considerable brand damage, and it will take a lot of ethereal advertising to repair that. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
There's a big immigration march scheduled for Washington this Sunday. Organizers are hoping to have as many as 100,000 people show up. They want to pressure Congress and the president to get going on an immigration bill. There are plus or minus 12 million illegal immigrants in this country. A lot of them are kids, some of them in high school. And when those kids graduate, their future is beyond just uncertain. They can't legally work, they can't drive, and in most cases, they're not eligible for government student aid. 18-year-old Sam is one of them. He was brought from Mexico to Indiana with his family when he was five. He's in college now. He's a music major. Independent producers Dan Collison and Elizabeth Meister have put together a documentary about Sam, including this slice about a trip to New York City.
This is really, really awesome. In 5 days, I'll be headed to New York to play for this organization called College Board. It's an organization that pretty much deals with SATs and stuff like that, you know. And they've asked me to play the national anthem for them.
Please rise for the national anthem performed by Sam, an honor student and recipient of the Woody Herman Outstanding Jazz Award from Indiana.
I'm kind of nervous, and I've never been to New York. Heck, I've never been to Chicago, so this is going to be quite an experience for me. It's a little weird to be asked to play the national anthem of a country that I'm not really of, I guess you could say. In a way, me playing the national anthem and, you know, respecting this country, it is putting in people's face, hey, look, I am American. I grew up with Power Rangers and Barney and all the same stuff you did. When the Star Spangled Banner is playing, I still put my hand over my heart because I take this country as my own. I just want to be recognized as an American because that's what I feel like I am.
We're going to get started now.
Thank I've also been asked to tell my story at a panel about the DREAM Act. That piece of legislation would basically allow students like me to gain citizenship.
As many of you may know, my name is Sam. You know, growing up, we were warned about a lot of things. You know, don't talk to strangers, don't get in an ice cream van with a weird guy. But also, we had the whole don't tell anyone, you know, what's going on.
It's always been, keep that to yourself. Don't tell anybody because they could turn us in, they could take everything away from us.
I feel like we are a shadow society, I guess. Always hiding, always fearful of being deported. And for me, coming here was a big risk to me because it could affect my family. I love this country very, very much, and I feel like if I were to gain legal status, I could chase my dream of being a musician.
I'm JP, and I'm 23.
JP was the other undocumented student on the panel with me.
I found out I was undocumented when I was 14 years old.
She got her bachelor's and her master's, but she can't use it because she's not documented.
Right now I'm working as a nanny for a family on the Upper West Side, and as grateful as I am to have a job, period, in this economy, I can't help but wish every day that I could use my degree.
One of the first things I thought when I heard JP's story was, wow, why should I keep going if that's just going to be me?
It's sad. I sit next to Sam, and I'm 6 years older, and he's just starting what, you know, I went through. And I think that's what's so tragic. It's been 6 years and still nothing. I'm still in the same spot.
I got terrified because I thought, man, I'm not going to be able to move forward.
We've come to the end of our time, and I don't want to hold you up, but...
Right after my panel, I had to go perform. I was trying to get out, and then this woman came up to me and she said,
Hi, how are you?
Pretty good.
It's very nice to meet you. I run a scholarship program for first-generation students. I got an email this morning that I have a little balance, so I wonder if you're interested in a scholarship.
And she just comes up and says, I'd like to help by giving you $2,000, and it was just completely left field, but in my favor.
Yeah, we're pretty much out of money, so... This is definitely going to be a great help.
So, this is my card. Do not lose it.
All right, well, I won't. The $2,000 scholarship basically means that I can finish the semester at least. Oh, it's such a relief. I'm really, really excited. I'm so happy right now.
Woo!
We are now on our way to the Statue of Liberty at Liberty Island.
That was a really, really neat experience because you know, visually, I didn't expect the Statue of Liberty to be that huge.
I'm Cynthia Marcucci, and I'm so pleased to be your guide today.
During the audio tour, I realized how many people, like, really sacrificed a lot, you know, to come here.
I'm holding one of the most precious things I'll ever have. It's a piece of thin cardboard, about 4 by 5 inches, with the words inspection card at the top. It says that Nicoletta Puzo had been passed by the Immigration Bureau and was permitted to enter the United States of America through the port of New York. She was 6 years old.
I think what we have in common is we just want the same thing, only in a different time period. We all just want the chance to live to our fullest potential. We're all looking for a better life for our families and our future generations.
Nicoletta was my grandmother. And for millions of families like ours, the statue was and is a powerful symbol of freedom and opportunity.
It's pretty humbling, actually. It just represents so much that I want to someday have. Hopefully my kids will be able to have, you know, that freedom. But we'll wait.
That's Sam playing us out there with Duke Ellington's In a Sentimental Mood. Our story was produced by Dan Collison and Elizabeth Meister for Long Haul Productions in association with Latino USA. You can hear all of Sam's story, and there is lots more of it. And you can see some photos as well on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by the New Harvard Business Review, a source of smart thinking for today's business world. The revival of smart begins at hbr.org. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note to send you into your weekend, should you be that rare combination of policy wonk and gambler, the free market has a place for you. We have mentioned online predictive markets like Intrade a couple of times on the show. You can buy contracts on where the Dow is going to end the year, whether Sarah Palin's going to be the Republican nominee in 2012, or on whether healthcare is going to pass. As of right now, the yes side's ahead at 83%. We'll see how right they were, of course, come Monday morning. But for right now, we got to go. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 37 points, a third of 1%. The NASDAQ dipped 16.7%. The S&P 500 lost about 5 points. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money. You know, with for sale signs out there galore, you might think it's a great time to buy a house. Except everybody else thinks so, too.
People's perception of what's going on isn't really what's going on. Everybody's in the marketplace for this time.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend. We'll talk to you again Monday.
American Public Media.